Remember, inspired by the Word of God, you can be more fully alive.
This is Full-Time Catholic Radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the Internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. Church and Culture may well recognize that musical theme from the great movie from 1961, El Cid, starring Charlton Heston and Sophia Loren. And our guest today, we're very lucky to have, is Greg Nestor, who is both the arranger and the guitarist in that you just heard, playing that theme by the great Hungarian composer Miklos Rosa. And I've asked Greg to join us today in order to talk about his life as a guitarist, an arranger, and a friend of Miklos Rosa, and about the career of Rosa himself. Greg, welcome to Church and Culture.
Well, thank you very much, Deal. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I should tell our listeners that you're quite a well-known guitarist, very active around the world in recordings. I'll let them know that I got to know you through hearing your recorded arrangements, not just of the film music of Miklos Rosa, but also his guitar sonata, his other chamber works. But also you've done arrangements of film composers such as the great Henry Mancini, Max Steiner, Franz Waxman and Eric Korngold, to name a few, because you've done a lot, and in the area of Broadway musicals as well.
I've also had a great interest in that, because I naturally was brought up as a classical guitarist. However, I didn't want to just remain in the box. I like to think outside the box. And so by expanding the repertoire in different areas for the instrument, I felt it was both good for the instrument and really quite a lot of fun to play, and got very good audience response, too.
Well, you are. I mean, if you go on Amazon or you go on iTunes or you just kind of look around for this film music that we all love. I mean, who doesn't love Mancini, Rosa, Steiner, Waxman, Rosa? Your name pops up. And you got out there ahead of most anybody that I can think of in arranging this very beautiful music, popular, well-known music, for your instrument, but you also include other instruments as well. I know that in the piece we're going to play also from El Cid, the love theme, I believe you have a flautist playing along with you.
Actually, it's a oboe.
I wondered what that was. I couldn't quite identify it.
It's an oboe, a violin, and two guitars on that particular recording, as is the El Cid overture.
Well, before we play it, I want to... You know, you said in general you wanted to expand the repertoire of the guitar, the audience for the guitar, and so forth.
When I was growing up, I was fortunate that when I went to San Diego State University, at that time they had a pretty well-developed guitar ensemble, and there was a lot of encouragement to do chamber music. In fact, I used to sneak away. I was in high school at the time, and I would sneak away under the fence in the back when maybe half day was over, catch a bus over to San Diego State, and then participate in chamber music.
Wow.
So I was an early escapee from...
So you weren't going out to smoke. You were going out to listen to guitar.
No, I was going over to play chamber ensemble and take advantage of that. And then I continued that experience on when I went to live in England and became very interested in voice and guitar and guitar in different combinations. And then it became a little bit of an obsession, a good obsession.
And then you ended up having a recital at the famous Wigmore Hall, what, in 1978?
That's right. Yeah, I did my debut at Wigmore Hall. Had a very nice response.
There's no greater venue to have your recital than there.
Except there was one funny instance in that it just happened that the agent that booked me didn't quite realize that Andres Segovia was playing exactly the same night in the Royal Festival Hall.
Uh-oh.
So that
must have been a bit of a blow to you to find that out.
It was quite fun. Well, they actually, the Wigmore Hall still sold out all the way.
Fantastic.
But, they actually did an article in the paper, something like, Why Greg Nister Wishes Segovia Was Not Playing.
Well, you got a very fine review. I looked it up. It said that you were uncommonly communicative, a real artist in timing and shading and stylish fluency, and tact besides wholehearted communication with his composers, which is something that I find in your recordings without fail.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. I was fortunate to get a nice review from the London Times.
What I want our listeners to do is to learn more about you and your recording, and as we go along, we'll talk more specifically about what to look for, whether ordering the CD or the download.
Since we
mentioned the love theme, the famous love theme from El Cid by Miklos Roza, and you arranged it, I think you said, for guitar, oboe, and violin. Is that right?
Right. Oboe, violin, and two guitars. The other thing that I think that would be worthwhile to point out is that in all the arrangements I did, Rocha, Mancini, and so forth, I was fortunate to be allowed to have direct access to the original scores and manuscripts. I wasn't doing a takedown, meaning I wasn't listening to an orchestral recording and just sort of guessing. I was actually working from the original urtext, so I was able to include as much as possible the composer's original markings, articulations, as close as possible that I could. So it was as accurate a presentation that was possible to make. It wasn't my guesswork.
And you got to know some of them, including Rocha.
That's right, Rocha.
We're going to talk about that in a second. Let's listen to the great love theme from El Cid.
Thank you.
Greg, it's very hard to cut into that. That is so lovely.
It's a beautiful theme. And it's very, very interesting in that Rocha did very extensive research. And the themes that he wrote for El Cid sound so natural and so Spanish, you might believe that they were in existence forever, but in fact they were not. He just was able to capture the idiom so well. So there's a special connection to him and the guitar in many different areas, which is great.
Well, actually, I was playing this piece to myself in my bedroom this morning getting ready for the interview, and my son walked in and said, "Is that Spanish?"
There you go.
You got to know Rocha. What were the circumstances under which you got to know the maestro?
Well, it was actually sort of interesting how it came about. It all starts actually in a coffee shop. Everything starts in a coffee shop. But I was in a coffee shop near Universal Studios and in Los Angeles, and I noticed a man reading a book on violin technique at the time. It turned out it was a gentleman named Manuel Kopinski, who was an old friend of Rocha. Manuel was a violinist, and he, when Rocha first wrote his violin concerto, before showing it to Heifetz, he showed it to Manuel to get some other technical feedback. I introduced myself to Manuel. It turned out he had made an arrangement on A Fantasy of Fiddler on the Roof. I was doing music preparation engraving. I prepared it for Manuel. And then he mentioned to me that a close friend of his was preparing a solo violin sonata and had asked him if he knew of someone who could prepare it and engrave it out for publishing. Well, that close friend turned out to be Miklos Rocha. And
wow.
Manuel took me up to meet Rocha. Dr. Rocha and I immediately felt very comfortable with each other.
So you called him doctor?
Yes, yes, out of respect.
Yes,
I did, because he was truly.
I want our listeners to realize a little bit here. We have a Hungarian composer born in Budapest, whose father didn't want him to be a composer. He went off to Leipzig to study chemistry, but he ended up at the conservatory.
That's right.
From where he went to Paris at the suggestion of the great organist Louis Dupré. But while in Paris, a good friend of his said, "Hey, I'm making some extra money composing for music," and that was Arthur Honegger, who had just finished composing Les Miserables. And so this led Rocha, when he went to London to meet Alexander Korda, for whom he composed his very first film score, Night Without Armor, with great Robert Donat as the starring lead.
That's right.
Which then led him to Hollywood, where his first great score was, and still a great score, Jungle Book, from 1940.
Yes, I believe what happened was when they came to do Thief of Baghdad, that was started, and it was going on during the war. Because of the war situation and for other reasons.
Thief of Baghdad, not Jungle Book. Jungle Book came later.
That's right.
Yes,
Thief
right.
of Baghdad. So he continued and went on to Hollywood where the continuation of that production was finished. And from there, he decided to transport and with himself and his family, and he liked the elements that were there in Hollywood as far as the climate and other
elements. Plus, he was leaving, Hitler's Europe.
That's right. That's right. And so then he continued on, and that's where he made his home. He always had his foot both firmly in film score and concert music.
Well, he had already made his reputation as an accomplished young man, a composer.
He was quite accomplished. Yeah. He was fully published by Breitkopf and Hartel by the mid to late 1920s. He had had very good success in the concert world before. Not that that really impressed anyone in Hollywood, but
that's right.
But once he was here, he had this great education and experience, and he was able to really have several different periods of his life in writing. At one point later on, he became the go-to person for Hollywood historical epics, and he did all these great research.
Yes, he did Ben-Hur. Quo Vadis.
Exactly.
And El
Cid. El Cid, finally, which was one of the third great epic, or the final epic, anyway, that he did, which was actually an independent film, but it was one of his truly one of his great scores.
Now, so let's continue the story a little bit. You were recommended then to do the engraving, publishing of the violin sonata. So tell us a little about the first moment you met, the first time you sat down with him.
Well, anyone that ever had the fortune to meet Miklós Rozsa always knew that you were always served cookies and on very, very beautiful, expensive silver set. And so that was just part of his tradition he brought in. And so he showed me the violin sonata, and it was, of course, all in his handwriting. He had had a copy made of it that I could work from. And we just felt immediately comfortable. We were able to talk on the same level. Now, keep in mind, at this point in time, he'd had several illnesses. He'd had a stroke. He had myasthenia gravis. So his speech was sometimes slurred. His mind was fully intact. So it was somewhat difficult always to completely understand him, but I learned to understand him very cleanly and clearly. And then we began to work together, and it was just a great pleasure.
Now, this would eventually lead to the great guitar sonata, which we're going to play some of, and we're going to talk in the second part of our interview.
That's right. That's right.
Over what period of time did you work? Did you work with him up close to his death, or what happened?
No, the guitar sonata was written in the late 80s, sort of 86 period. I started working with him just a year or so before that point, and we continued to work on various other projects beyond the guitar sonata up until another year or two after that. At that point, health concerns, he simply couldn't compose or write anymore.
Well, his last film score was 1982.
That's right. That's right. So then he had moved over, and he wanted to write a series of solo sonatas. And so that's how I eventually became involved. And, of course, I always loved his film scores. And he very kindly let me borrow his original sketches. So he let me take them home. They were all in his room there. And I very carefully photocopied them and kept them and had them as a reference. So I went through everything that I thought might be viable, not just solo guitar, but, of course, two guitars. There was also a suite I adapted for flute, oboe, cello, and guitar, sort of a suite of ancient dances that he wrote sometimes as source music for films. And also I adapted the viola concerto for guitar.
Now, you had to have permission to do all this, right?
Yeah, well, he simply opened up and let me do that. Now,
he obviously trusted you and respected you a great deal and let you do this.
Yeah. And that was, you know, because at that particular point, the rapport was fine and we felt very comfortable. And, you know, it was absolutely fine. I was very, very, obviously very, very careful with his
You sure were. Now, I selfishly put in what might be my favorite of the Rozsa film scores. It's the score to That Hamilton Woman, 1941, Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh. Let's listen to this great love theme. Greg, as someone who's listened to that countless times and has it memorized, you absolutely hit a home run with that arrangement. Thank you
very much. I appreciate it.
I'm talking with Greg Nestor, a world-renowned guitarist, arranger, very, very important to the world, not just of guitar, but also of the transcription. I think you just finished an entire transcription of the Schubert songs. Is that correct?
Yes, yes.
That's a big job.
It is, but it's also been a lot of fun to do. It's been a lot of fun to do.
So that means that someone then can sing the song with guitar accompaniment. Is that right? Is that how it works? Is this just a complete transcription for solo guitar?
Right.
Okay. Like Franz Liszt made piano transcriptions of the Schubert songs.
Exactly.
So in other words, somebody can just pick up a guitar. And how many Schubert songs did you transcribe?
There were 163 Schubert songs that I arranged. Not just Schubert, but Schubert, Brahms, and Schumann. And I'd actually arranged them back in the late 70s and then continued on and recently revised them, and then finally have them now in publication or just about to be published with a company called Clear Note Publications. So it's actually the whole leader that I selected, which has been a lot of fun.
Well, that's a huge amount of work.
It's been a huge amount of work to do. It really, really has. But
given the popularity of German leader and the wonderful melodic quality of those, I'm sure they'll find an audience. And I want just to tell our listeners that we've been listening to recordings from Greg Nestor's CD, also available on download on iTunes, of the Miklos Rozsa Collection, Music for Guitar. And it's been available since 2008. Once again, Miklos Rozsa Collection, Music for Guitar, available on Amazon or any online CD retailer or on iTunes. Let's listen to another of my favorites, which Rozsa wrote for a French movie, Providence, and it's a waltz, and it's beautiful. Let's hear it. Nestor, when you arrange a piece like that and play it, does it choke you up ever, or do you have to remain detached from it?
I have to remain detached, but you know, just coming across and hearing it the first time, I have the same reaction that any listener would have. I mean, it grabs me or it doesn't grab me, and something that I think, this is going to work on the instrument, this is not, or it's just such a beautiful jewel. These are Rozsa wrote so many beautiful jewels, and the thing is that even in so-called source music, which might be music you may have written for background music, just sort of underneath a scene or something,
right?
It was still expertly and beautifully written, and often very movies, things like the Time Machine Waltz from Time After Time. And, you know, this is just light music that was heard in the background, but it's so beautifully composed it stands by itself.
And were there any pieces of Rozsa that you didn't get to do that you wished you could have done?
Well, I had access to everything that I thought would work. And so I can't really say there was anything that I didn't examine in detail. Obviously, it would not have made sense to do the rowing music from Ben-Hur. That would have been...
Right, on guitar, I don't think so.
Like, right. That would be just like doing the Ride of the Valkyries.
It's just, right, you could do it on drums, maybe, but...
Yes, or speak the zoos. So you just select very, very carefully.
I notice a lot of it is sort of dance-related.
Yes. Yeah, well, that was often some of the source music and some of the waltzes that would work. Now, the example you played of that Hamilton, that's one of the most beautiful themes, and I think I selected it also because there's so many. He captured this sort of beautiful English quality that one might hear in Delius or Butterworth. There's that.
Two of my favorite composers, of course.
Two of these, it's timeless music. It really, really is, and it just feels so perfect that. It's hard to resist not wanting to do something with it.
Well, we're just thrilled to have you as a guest here Church and Culture. And we're only halfway through our interview, and I know that our listeners will stay with us because we'll be back just after this message.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, inviting you to join me as we explore some of the deepest questions that arise in our hearts. Questions that shape the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we live. For all of these questions, Christ is the answer.
Throughout most of his ministry, Father John Ricardo has spoken to men's groups. He's challenged them to give more of themselves to God and to desire, above all else, to draw closer to him. On our next program, we listen to a talk he gave to a large men's group about the need we have for male friendship. It's an essential component of the new evangelization. Listen to Christ is the Answer Wednesday evenings at 8, Saturday evenings at 6, and Sunday mornings at 11 on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the image of the invisible God. He points us to our destiny. He reveals the dignity of the human person. He is the one who makes known the Father. Christ is the Answer.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
People like to bash the faithful with statistics. For instance, you've probably heard that studies show that Christians divorce at the same rate as others. Or how about the report that claims that Christians are bad tippers? Well, according to the University of Connecticut sociologist Bradley Wright, statements like these simply don't apply to people who actually practice their faith. For instance, only 25% of weekly church-going Catholics are divorced, compared to 50% of the general population. As for tipping, a Cornell University study found that church-going Christians tip an average of 17%. Obviously, Christians aren't perfect, but practicing our faith really does give us the grace we need to stand up against the pressures the world can apply. So the next time someone tries to bash your faith with research, take it with a grain of salt. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
I'm back with Greg Nestor, guitarist, arranger, friend to not just guitar buffs, but to film music buffs, because he's arranged and published so many wonderful performances of film music in a chamber form, solo guitar, but also guitar and other instruments. One of my favorite of your recordings is your arrangement of Miklos Rose's score for a very obscure film from 1941, Lydia, which was a Merle Oberon vehicle, directed by Julien Duvivier. Why did you choose Lydia?
Well, I had heard the recording of Lydia. There was a point that Rozsa went to London, and he recorded, I believe, with either the Royal Philharmonic or London Symphony, and he did a series of suites for a recording. And this was one of the ones that I had access to, using the suite. I happen to love it. Also, there's this beautiful canonic imitation. You have the theme, dee-da-da-da-da-da-da, and it
right.
keeps going backwards and forwards. And one of the things that reminded me of a great deal was a great colleague who wrote Rocha. One of his colleagues was named Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco, who had
a great composer himself.
That's right. And they did work on some collaborations. And the canonic imitation that Rocha uses in Lydia is very much in Tedesco's style. So those elements grabbed me, and I really thought it was a wonderful piece. And also the waltz has a sort of a Ravelian quality to it. The only change that I made in Lydia was there was a sequence that I found in the original scores called the Harlequin sequence. And the melody is it's a very, very lively piece. And I decided that it would be nice to insert that before the recapitulation at the end. So that's what I did. I added the Harlequin sequence.
Let's take a listen. Lydia, the Lydia Suite as arranged by Greg Nestor, composed by Miklos Rosa. That little waltz theme that you inserted?
The waltz theme was part of it. But after that, after the waltz theme, there's a piece called the Harlequin. So that comes a little bit later. That was actually part of the original suite that Rocha had initially put together.
So it's so hard to say stop. they're such beautiful pieces.
Don't stop, yeah.
I feel like we've kind of worked up now to the Sonata of Guitar, which you
thank you
had direct input into. And now, did you give the maestro the idea for this composition?
Yes. I want to just mention one thing. The collaborator on the two guitar recordings that I worked with on these was Bill Kannengeiser of the LA Guitar Quartet. So I should definitely...
Oh, very well-known quartet.
Because it was both he and I. He's the one that recorded with me most of the guitar duos that we're hearing today.
Okay, wonderful.
So the guitar sonata evolved out of my workings with Miklos Rocha directly. And it started at the time... when I first met him, he was in the process of working on a violin sonata we discussed earlier. And that went for some time because there were a number of changes and so forth. And at some particular point, I said to him, you know, one of your great colleagues, Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco, had written quite a number of works for guitar. There's a beautiful sonata, which is a homage to Boccherini, which is quite popular. And he said, well, how long is the piece? I said, it's about 16 minutes. And I let it drop at that. I sort of planted the idea in his mind, and I didn't say anything more about it. I knew he was going to think about writing a sonata for harp, and I was going to try my best to change the rudder of the ship towards the guitar. And then I was at home, and then I got this call. And, you know, Rocha had a very distinct Hungarian voice, naturally. And pardon my trying to imitate him, but I had this voice at the other end and said, well, I finished the first movement of the guitar sonata. I don't know how good it is.
What did you think of it when you heard it? Or did you read the score first, or did you play it?
Said to me, it was great because obviously there was going to be a lot of things to make it viable on the instrument. And so as I sat down, immediately I could see how wonderful potential it was. So as I began to work on it, what I did is I recopied it out as clean as possible and as he wrote it, and then the various changes I was thinking of or expanded out so it was playable, I wrote in red. So it was sort of a score that was sort of black and red. And then we got together, and I finally had a chance to play it for him. And then we went a sort of a back-and-forthing on it, and he would say, let's tighten this up. And I said, yes, but there's nothing like this in the guitar. Let's keep that in. Anyway, he was very viable, this whole thing. And in the end, we tried to take out any superfluous measures that really didn't need to be there. So it was as lean and clean as possible, so everything counted. And make it work on the instrument. It was a great collaboration and really great, great fun. It was such a pleasure to finally sit down and play it for him. He was on various medications at the time, and his nurse came in, and he just waved her off. He didn't have anything.
Well, you know he's having a good time.
He was having a great time, and the ending of the piece with the large strums and Grosciato chords, he literally sucked in his breath because it was so exciting for him. And then when he got done, he said, very, very good.
That must have made you feel wonderful. Let's hear the first part of the first movement, the Sonata for Guitar by Miklos Rozsa, played by Greg Nestor. Greg, this is music that really is compelling. I mean, it's really going somewhere, and it makes you want to know, where is this going?
Yeah, there's a feeling of almost through composed. You know, everything balances out, and this piece is structured on this repeated bass, bum 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 bum,
which sounds like something out of one of his film noir scores.
That's right. As a matter of fact, you'll hear a suggestion of it I think it's The Last Embrace, some of the thematic. But that's a figuration, and he builds the entire first movement on that, and then you find variants of that all the way first, the first movement. And then the second movement is more of a beautiful almost like a Hungarian folk song. And like his through-composed love themes or film scores, it has a feeling of an inevitability. It just moves you through the piece.
It's like it's propelled. Well, let's go to – I don't want to lose out on getting as much of this music in here as we can. So
sure.
Let's move on to the second movement of the Sonata for Guitar. Greg, does this music express Rozsa's mood as an older man at the time? I'm just curious about that.
Well, I think, as in many of his film epics, he focused on underlying, and if there was a visual in a film in terms of character, a lot of times the music tended to harmonically reflect some of the attitudes of the character, and the music expressed what may have not been directly said in the dialogue. And I think in slower movements like that, he was able to express very deep yearnings, very deep feelings, and the register that he wrote it in allowed an almost rich quality to the instrument. And it has a lot of contrapuntal writing in it also. So it set very, very well on the instrument for that purpose.
Was he a man in his latter years who was happy with his life, with what he had done?
Well, I think he was very happy and contented. He knew his worth and his value. But he was not a man of, at least as I knew him, of overpowering ego. He was very appreciative of things. I had a bit of a laugh. When I first recorded the sonata, I had it transferred over. At that point, this is the 86, I had it transferred over to a cassette tape, and he had a little Walkman. So he's sitting in his room, and I bring it, and he starts to play it, and he has it turned up full volume. And the thing is breaking up, and it's crackling, and I'm cringing. And he gets done, and he goes, "Very good." And I said, "Oh, it was not." it was quite funny. It was quite funny. But, he was very gracious, and yet he was very assertive on what he believed and what he wanted. Of course, I respected that about him as much as possible.
Well, tell us what we should listen for in the part, the opening part of this last movement.
He really saves the fireworks for the last movement. You have this da 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 da, and often, even with his concerti, the quick movements are these strong rhythmic pulses that carry.
Very Hungarian, I guess, huh?
Yes, yeah. This is the Hungarian pulse, and so much of the rhythmic aspect and these surprises. So here he's using the guitar. He's using the open E string of the guitar, the upper E string of the guitar, as well as punctuated chords underneath for a great rhythmic effect. And it just is a driving, almost a multi-purpose. perpetual sort of an effect that builds and builds to the end. So it's quite exciting. But it's not all the fireworks, all the earlier, all the inherent intimacy of the guitar is shown, and here we have the fireworks being released.
Well, let's hear some of those fireworks. The third movement, final movement of the Sonata for Guitar by Rocha, played by Greg Nestor. It occurs to me as I'm listening to this that it sounds more like his film music than the other two movements of the sonata.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? Actually, the last movement is structured as a rondo. You have the basic thematic, and then you have development coming back to the rondo theme, which you hear from the beginning. So that's how it's based, that those elements are based all the way through. But it's quite a challenge to play, but it's a heck of a lot of fun.
Does he get many performances?
It's getting a lot more. It was almost immediately published by G. Scherber. And Bill Kannengeisser, who again I had worked with on the duo parts of the recording, actually at his Carnegie Hall debut performed it, premiered it. And then there's been some recent new recordings which have started to come up. I think there's a Chinese young lady guitarist that's recorded it. There's an Italian guitarist, and from what I hear, it's getting a lot more play. It's also been picked up quite naturally by a lot of Hungarian guitarists. I get a lot of response and hear from them because it's obviously something they're championing. In fact, there was a large guitar competition and get-together a couple of months ago in the Los Angeles area, and one of the guitarists who played it as one of his finalists concert.
Well, that must have made you very proud.
It's good to get it out there, and it's great to do this for the legacy of the instrument.
My impression is, when I was converted to classical music in my early 20s and was collecting music right and left, and hit this dead end with the atonal and the 12-tone music, and I very luckily discovered this rich vein of American and European film music. And I say that I threw in European because many of the great American film composers were, in fact, European.
That's right.
And they were carrying on the post-Romantic traditions of Richard Strauss and Wagner and so forth, that I came to the conclusion that the music I loved, at least for sometime, went in, you know, was being written for film rather than for the concert hall. Don't you think that's being recognized now?
Far more. I mean, there are far more concerts that are being done of film music, and film music presentations, both past and present. And symphonies are acquiring new audiences based on that, because it's a great thrill for them to see this. And often they'll combine it with the visual. But in many cases, such as Roche's music, the music really stands by itself. You don't need to have, I mean, if the visuals it conjures up in your mind present itself. A love theme from The Thief of Baghdad, for instance, or, as you said, from Lady Hamilton. Everything that's intrinsic about that particular, it doesn't have to be a film, just the genre, it's all captured there. It's captured. Even if you haven't been to England, it gives you a sense of what that period is like.
Well, because composers like Steiner and Waxman and Roja were very cultured. They were cosmopolitan men. They knew the world.
That's right. That's right.
And I think John Williams and Ennio Morricone and others in our generation have carried on that great tradition.
And John Williams has freely acknowledged the contribution of Rocha and Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco. Same with Jerry Goldsmith. All of them at one point studied with Tedesco or knew him and were greatly appreciative. I went to Rocha's, let me think, it would have been about his, I'm trying to think what birthday it was. It was like in 88 or 89. Big celebration. And at his house, you had Billy Wilder, John Williams, Andre Previn, Henry Mancini. I mean, it was
my jealousy is just exploding.
It was
at this
just
moment.
An incredible collection of people that showed up. Kirk Douglas. Kirk Douglas, of course, because of Lust for Life. They were all there. They were all there to honor him. You know, he was very, very humble about it. He really, really was. But
as very accomplished men often are,
I simply stayed in the corner and kept my mouth shut and just enjoyed.
Well, before we leave, I want to go back to one of the cuts that we played earlier, and then thank you for all you've done for us
it's been a pleasure. It really has been enjoyable.
So let's listen to once again for a piece of the love theme from El Cid, as played by Greg Nestor and his friends. It's a sin against beauty to stop that, but our time is gone. I want to thank Greg Nestor once more for being our guest on Church and Culture.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure today.
And once again, Greg Nestor, that's with two G's. His music can be bought through Amazon, through iTunes. Just make sure you put in two G's, and you'll see his wonderful recordings. This one is the Miklos Rozsa collection, music for guitar. Thank you again, Greg.
It's a pleasure, Jill. Thank you.
To all of you who are listening, another wonderful guest around the corner. Please stay with us till after this next message.
At the 2011 Marian Conference at Boyne Mountain, Father Ben Lucky's title was, Roman Catholicism is a force to be reckoned with.
We are Roman Catholic Christians, for God's sake. We are not just a bunch of pious people. We are Roman Catholic Christians who know the fullness of truth, who have the fullness of faith, who have the Eucharist, the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ, present in the most blessed sacrament of the altar. We have a mother in faith, the Blessed Virgin Mary. We have the Holy Father as the visible head of the Holy Roman Catholic Church, the mystical body of Christ.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. On our next program, Father Ben speaks on how we, as faithful Catholic Christians, should unapologetically be and live in the world. Listen to Roman Catholicism as a Force to be Reckoned With on Putting on the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet. Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
Is discipline kind? Isn't this the third time I've asked this week? Yes, it is, and I'm going to ask it all week. We said discipline is kind, first of all, because if we teach now, our children will not have to learn later at the hands of the world. Do you want another reason why discipline is kind? I will tell you in a story. A mother said to me once, the worst handicap I could give my child would be to allow him to be unlikable. I am his mother. I will always love him. Other people will not. They will look at him at age 8, at age 12, and say, that's an obnoxious little brat. That's an unpleasant human being. Other children won't play with him. Babysitters will leave by the handful. The Sunday school teacher will dread his face in the door. She said, I do not want people thinking of my child that way. That is cruel to my child. My discipline, gently, lovingly, but firmly holding my son accountable for his behavior, will teach him to be a much more pleasant human being. And in so being, he will feel positive reactions from other people, not negative ones. And that's another reason why discipline is quite kind. I'm Dr. Ray.
You remember the day you first laid eyes on her. They handed you the keys and you drove back home for everyone to admire. And although the memories have been made, it's time to pass the torch to someone else. Consider donating your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Even if it's not running, we'll take care of everything from pickup to your tax receipt. Just call 866-628-CARS to show you just how easy it is to donate. That's 866-628-CARS. And mention Ave Maria Radio.
Homeschool graduate Krista Horning has written a book which, according to Johnny Erickson Tata, lovingly leads kids with disabilities beyond their questions to discover just how wise and sovereign God really is. Join Mike Ferris on Homeschool Heartbeat as he talks with Krista about finding joy beyond her disability.
Krista, your mom tells your story with great candor and obvious love for you. God's personal tender care for you and your family is so clear. Looking back, what overarching truth stands out to you the most?
I've experienced the suffering and sadness of disability.